Well, I think Pete looks like a little bit of an easy target. And I think in part, he's the new kid on the block. He's a rookie head coach. He's in this league with folks who he's revered on a certain level now. When you look at like a Kirby Smart, and when you're Pete Golding and you're the DC at Alabama, I mean, that's the vaunted figure of like what your career could become, right? And so now you're kind of sharing the table with Sark and Lane, who was your boss, and Kirby, and a lot of these other big time, well established coaches. One, so you don't have the confidence to throw your weight around. Two, like you've got an ugly mugshot in your past. Three, the Clemson tampering issue is looming over your head as well. Not to mention you're trying to figure out how to run a program. So I don't think he's got the footing he needs in his career or in his sort of level of self-assuredness to kind of stand up to some of the crap that Ole Miss is getting right now.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's get into the list. We've got a new mock draft from Sam Vecenie to discuss, as well as some news from, let's see, we also had, of course, the NBA last night. Wanted to get into a couple of thoughts there, as well as an update on the PGA Championship. We'll talk about all that during the list next segment when we come back, right here on Jeff Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Leaders Credit Union is the presenting sponsor of Dancing with the Stars Memphis, benefiting the YMCA of Memphis and the Mid-South. It's the second year that they have been the presenting sponsor, and it's quickly become one of the most exciting community events here in Memphis. And it's all about community leaders stepping outside of their comfort zones and onto the dance floor for a great cause. The event is June 4th at the Agri Center. Tickets are on sale now at dancingmemphis.com, dancingmemphis.com. And if last year is any indication, tables will sell out, so don't wait. This year's lineup includes the following dancers: Penelope Houston, Nicholas Thompson, Courtney Carter, Linda McNeil, John Stamps, Samelia Pelshak, Will Patterson, Dr. Lynn Foley, shout out my buddy Ryan, and David Bradford, Shondell Ryan, Kim Clark, Ayoka Pond, and John Gillespie. West Tennessee has been the home of Leaders for over 70 years, and they're dedicated to strengthening the community because Leaders believes that together we can all make a difference. And as a local not-for-profit institution, Leaders reinvest their profits back into their members and the community by offering lower rates on loans, high rates on deposits, investing in technology, and giving back to the community. You can go to the special webpage they've created just for our listeners, leaderscu.com/ESPN, to learn how they can champion your financial story and even waive your membership fee. Jason Smith's going to join us during the next segment. Before we do that, let's get into the list. The NBA draft. All right, Cobb, Sam Vecenie over at The Athletic has released his latest mock draft. He has A.J. DeBonta going 1 to the Wizards. He has Darren Peterson going 2 to the Jazz. And he has Cam Boozer going at 3 to the Grizzlies. The rest of the top 10 plays out as follows. The Bulls selecting Caleb Wilson at 4. The Clippers taking Keaton Wagler at 5. The Nets taking Darius Acuff at 6. The Kings taking Kingston Flemings at 7. Mikel Brown to the Hawks at 8. Braden Burries to the Mavs at 9. Nate Amint to the Bucks at 10. He also, I believe, has Koa Pete going to the Grizzlies at 16. Again, we talked about whether or not Koa will actually stay in the draft. Does seem to have become a question here at the Combine. But I do think that it's an interesting situation because it's kind of what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. How strong of a reality do you think that it is that the Grizzlies wind up coming out of this draft without getting a lead guard?
I would say 75% chance they're going to take a swing at a guy. Now, if it's 16 or 32 where they end up taking a guard, I don't know that you just write that guy in as like, oh yeah, we're depending on him to be the future face or the future lead guard for this franchise. Now, if you trade up, I think that's what you're signaling. We're trading up because we're taking somebody who we think could be that. Now, if you take a guard at 16 or 32, I think your expectations for what they could truly be have to be lower. You're entering that player into the category of Cam Spencer, Scottie Pippen Jr., Walter Clayton Jr., right? You're not anointing that player as some future cornerstone at 16 or at 32. If you trade up, you take a guard at 12 or 10 or wherever, in your theory, maybe even 5. Well, yeah, then that's your future lead guard. I would say, though, 75 to 80% chance they come away from draft night with a guard who's at least worth taking a look at in that sort of role.
We're talking about, you know, the difference of whether or not they had 6 and 10 versus, you know, 3 and 16. I think the other windfall is also the fact that by Brooklyn and the Kings dropping, they also drop to a spot where it feels like both of them are going to be in the place where, all right, well, you just take one of these guards. And so then that becomes the question of, have you eliminated two teams that could have been a potential fit for Ja?
Yeah. Seems like the Kings are the only one dumb enough to like really entertain it. No, I shouldn't say it that way. Ja Morant, let me tell you, I think he could still have 5 more All-Star seasons ahead of him. What a bright future this young man has on the basketball
maybe
court.
Maybe 10.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe 10 more All-Star seasons. I like where you're going. I think he could get back in the MVP conversation and really be a role model in his next community. So if I were an NBA franchise out there, I would spare no expense. I would pony up and pay big for Ja.
This was something George and I were discussing yesterday. Has the market changed for Ja since the deadline?
Well, there was a proposal floating around out there that we talked about on these airwaves, either me and you or me and Gabe, about like a Jalen Green. I'd be willing to entertain that. Like, give me a look at Jalen Green. Sure, if that's on the table, absolutely, I'd be down for something like that. At least give me something to take a look at in terms of, hey, all right, like maybe the haul for Ja Morant isn't what we hoped it would be when he was at his prime. But if you're giving me a chance at a guy like that in return, I think that would be a really nice sort of return.
Is that something that's realistic, though?
I don't think so, but it was at least trotted out there hypothetically. Look, you're going to have to give up assets to get Ja out of town.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because I always thought the biggest risk by not moving him at the deadline was you were operating under the assumption that the market would be different in the summer. I guess we have to see how the draft plays out, but I'm not really, well, like, I always thought the big fear was, how is the market really going to be that different? And it feels to me that it's not.
Well, if it's different enough to where you can just get out without parting with a draft pick, like if you can just take back some bad money to get rid of him, win. Because that's not the way it was at the deadline.
I think that's the goal. I think that's their goal. I'm just not as convinced. If you had the same offers at the deadline, like, I'm just not as convinced that they're going to be materially different now.
I think at the deadline, a lot of teams they're less future focused than they are
right now. Yeah.
They're looking at what they can acquire to help them down the stretch of the regular season to shore themselves up for the playoffs. And if there are some peripheral future benefits to whatever transaction they can make, then so be it. But I think the difference about the offseason is teams are thinking more future oriented. They're thinking 3 to 5 years out instead of 3 to 5 months out. And that gives you a few more players in the conversation.
Anything else stand out to you from Vecini's latest mock?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Coapete at 16 is realistic because of the week that he's had. I think when Sam put this mock out, it was probably before some of the less,
yeah,
promising stuff started to come out on Coapete. So I wouldn't read too much into that, to be quite honest. I like seeing a guy like LeBaron Filon still on the board at 13 in his mock, because if by some twist of fate he were there at 16, boy, then we're cooking. Like, you come out of this thing with Bylon and Boozer.
And even if he's not available, even if you don't think he's at 16, it feels like it's going to be a lot easier to move up from 16 to 13 or 12 than it is to move up into what we were talking about, you know, to get your shot at one of the lead guards early.
You could be talking about partnering with a future second rounder, right? Like, sometimes that's the only price to move up two or three picks. Like, when the Grizzlies moved up to get Brandon Clark from 23 to 21, I mean, they didn't have to give up much to do it, and turned out to be a great decision, you know? I think if you've got one left on the board, if Braden Burry's were to slip, and I'll say it, Jeffrey, I think Mikal Brown Jr. is ripe to slip in this draft. And I wouldn't love taking a top 10 pick on Mikal Brown Jr. if I'm the Memphis Grizzlies. But if he's somehow there in the teens, I think it becomes more palatable to give him a look. I don't think he will be, for whatever reason. Like, he seems to be passing everything with flying colors, even though there were a lot of the same red flags there as there were with Darren Peterson. I think physically there's some red flags there. But at 16, I mean, or if he's there at 12 or 13 and you want to trade up, like, I'd be willing to entertain that in a way that I wouldn't, you know, in terms of maybe picking him at 6 or 7 or wherever.
Reportedly, he's had a good combine, right?
And again, I hadn't seen a whole lot about him, but
I think he has had a good week. Now, to your earlier point, I'm not sure how much it matters. I think we won't start to see. I don't think we'll start to see a whole lot of movement on the board, if you will, until teams start having these guys at the facilities. I think that's when you'll start to see, when they start really digging in and they basically do like all the in-person stuff, that's when you'll start to see a lot of lying. That'll be smokescreen season. But I also think that's when you're going to get a deeper sense of which teams are really looking into which guys and what they value.
Yeah, and Mikal Brown Jr. knows how to play the game, which is why I don't necessarily think he'll slip. I think he can sit face-to-face with an executive and not be uncomfortable and not be intimidated and rattle through the answers. Like, it's not necessarily like a concerns that I have in terms of like his professionalism in an interview setting, but his physical, I mean, from the Grizzlies' point of view, you want to talk about a guy with physical red flags for an injury-plagued franchise? He's got a slender frame, and he's already got back issues. And, I mean, actually, the back issues really started when Memphis played at Louisville.
Yeah.
And he crashed down going up for a rebound in that game. And he wasn't the same after that. Either there's a serious issue there that kept him from really playing much at all down the stretch, or he just decided to mail it in because he had gotten paid already and he didn't want to risk it. And, like, I don't love that. I just don't love that when you're on a – When you're getting paid millions of dollars to play in front of 18,000 fans in one of the most basketball crazed college programs, you know, in America, and you decide that that your NBA draft stock is worth more than, you know, getting paid, doing what you got paid to do, like, I just don't love that. And I think that's a part of the question there with Mikal Brown Jr.
Well, I also think there's this weird reality of, okay, we can all fundamentally understand not wanting to hurt your stock, but you're getting paid and that's not enough to motivate you. Is the rookie contract, your rookie, is that enough motivation? Like, what are you talking about? What's the amount of money that's going to motivate you to be, you know, really gutting it out? Is it the second contract? Is it just having a guaranteed deal? Like, that's kind of where I always start to, like, wonder. It's like, man, if you were kind of dogging it for $5 million, why is it going to be that much different when you're getting paid $7
million? When people show you who they are, believe them. That's sort of where I come down on it. Now, you might say, well, then, David, why would you be in favor of Darren Peterson over Cam Boozer if Peterson's there at...
Well, he said it was creatine.
Right.
And
right.
I love but that. Now,
I think the upside with Peterson is so great that if you have the chance to take him, maybe other than one, anywhere other than one, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Well, and also, whenever I hear the creatine story, I'm like, okay, it's good, because at the minimum, that means he's PED curious. At the best case scenario for me, that means also creatine's just a cover for maybe already being on PEDs, which I'm in love with. You know, it's kind of like when McGuire used to put Andro in his locker so that everybody wouldn't think he was on steroids. He was just doing Andro. Like, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, good. Love to hear the competitive spirit.
Please tell me you did Darren Peterson as a tell your own story.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, that was tremendous. Now, I did not love that he tried to make it a sob story.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't love that. I own it. Now I'm going to blame his agents on that. Like that was their media strategy. But it did make me start to think a little differently.
If I play poorly this weekend, I'm going to say that it was because I crushed too much protein in the weeks leading up
too
to
much
the trip.
Whey. Yeah. I was hitting the gym way too hard.
Yeah.
The Detroit Pistons. Cobb, in general, I think we've gone too far on always blaming refs. Man, I thought last night the Pistons might have had a case.
I agree.
I don't know how much you got to catch of it. I was curious. So on the final play of regulation, Allen clearly trips Thompson. They don't call it. Now, I don't think you can review that, right? Because nothing was called. What did not make sense to me was it appeared the ball went out of bounds well before the clock had expired. Can they not review that? I thought they can review clock stuff.
They should be able to review that, yeah. So the ball hits down with what, like point?
It looked like point four to me, maybe.
Right. Enough time to maybe catch and shoot. JB went off, though. I love playoff JB. Like, when he's not afraid of that little fine when it matters, you know?
He might be one of the biggest examples of literally Jekyll and Hyde. Like, when you see him in any setting away from basketball, like one of those, the kindest, like most, like respectful, easygoing guys. But man, it's like you put him on the sideline and he just sees red.
Well, I think he stands up for his team really well.
No, and to be clear, like, I actually kind of think like that's the best way to be. Like, all right, if that's like, if you're just going to be in that setting, that's cool. Like, it doesn't affect you like everywhere else, but like, it is a striking contrast.
I love it. I think it's part of what makes him a really good coach. Like, he has a good feel for when his team needs him to stand up for them, when his star players need to be stood up for. And granted, whatever, it got sideways in Cleveland with Donovan Mitchell, and maybe they've buried the hatchet there. But I respect JB for saying what he said and for calling it out. I think he was right. I think Ausar Thompson got fouled there. And I think, this is going to be a very, very interesting. Now, you can say it doesn't matter because the Knicks are going to wipe the floor with whoever comes out of this series. Like, maybe that's true. But the plot line here of the number one seed, JB Bickerstaff, having to go to Detroit down 3-2 to beat Cleveland, like, this is a really good NBA playoff storyline here. And, like, the Pistons' backs are against the wall here. Like, that fan base is starved for success, and they had it this year. But if you exit in the second round against that team with some of the history there, I that's not a good feeling.
Now, I know, like, you can also point out, like, the Pistons probably shouldn't have been in that position.
They were up 9 with, what, 2.5 minutes to go. Like, they just had to... That's the inexplicable part of it. And I guess all the credit in the world to Cleveland for the shot make. I mean, Evan Mobley.
Not only the shot making, and I think I kind of agreed with Legler. a guy that's what, like a 60% free throw shooter, because he hit that three, it felt like he got up to the line and those, like, those two free throws to tie the game were like stone cold.
Yeah. Well, and then even in the overtime, like, Harden missed a free throw
and got his own rebound. That was, God, that's a killer.
You got, in the NBA, down three with 10 seconds in the ball, that's an eternity. You run the floor in transition after the free throw miss, you get a quick two, you still got 6 seconds left, or you kick it for a three. Like, I mean, you just got to get that rebound. That was brutal.
Well, and you can't let the free throw shooter get his own rebound.
And now think about this. Like, we're one game away from James Harden playing in the Eastern Conference Finals. Like,
after we spent the first two games, like, just laughing.
Yeah.
Now, there's still chances for game 6 and 7, James Harden Magic.
No doubt.
Like, because George was asking before the show, he's like, it's over, right? And it's like, I mean, I guess at this point, like, you've seen enough basketball to know, like, well, maybe not, but God, that felt like that. You could just feel that whole building, and you're like, man, that felt like a couple of losses there.
Well, now to your point, like, it's on Cleveland, a franchise that in its post-LeBron, you know, sort of existence doesn't have the strongest track record of closing out series. I mean, this is kind of why they moved on from JB on a certain level. It's like he couldn't get it done in the playoffs. And then last year they lost in the Eastern Conference semifinals. And here they are with a chance to close one out. You know, can they do it? I don't know how much of a chance I give either of these teams against the Knicks, but I will say this series does have my attention.
With all of that said, George, you can chime in here. I don't think that was the most brutal loss of the night. I don't know how much of TNT you had on, Cobb.
Oh, boy.
But God bless those good people of Minnesota and the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Cobb, they are up 3-1 on the road against the Avs. 3.5 minutes left, George, before the first goal goes in?
Give or take.
They're up basically, you can surrender a goal.
Sure.
Like, you're fine. Like, you know, hey, it's going to be 6-on-5. They're going to pull the goalie, and you're not going to have the advantage. They give up the goal to make it 3-2. And then with like 45 seconds later, McKinnon, who the game before had his front teeth basically knocked out by a puck, rips maybe the goal of the year, and 3-3, and it's just over. You know, like, they're going to overtime, and it took like 2.5 minutes.
The goal in overtime was a beauty as well. Goal, like, anything that could have gone wrong for the Wild in that moment went horribly wrong.
And it was just like the lasting image, the goalie collapses. So the Avs basically get the puck, they go all the way around the net, and then they just fire an absolute missile. And there was like nothing he could do. And you just watched him like collapse in slow motion, and you're like, yeah, no, it's basically everyone in pretty much in Minneapolis.
Clinching the series, too.
Yep. I think that was the loss of the night.
Hockey losses are devastating, especially in OT.
Well, it's because it's so sudden. Like,
sudden death.
Literally the definition of sudden death.
And those celebrations are unreal. Like, that's the beauty of, I mean, it's like a buzzer beater. It's like, but you get them all the time.
Correct. That was absolutely brutal. All right, we'll save a few of the other topics, including the PGA Championship. We'll talk about that coming up to start hour number 3, but let's take a break. And when we come back, Jason Smith joins the program. We'll talk to him next, right here, Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Jason Smith is the co-host of the J&J Show. Start your day with J&J from 9 a.m. till noon. He's on the Everything app at Jason Smith 929. Jason, Team Cam or Team Caleb?
I started firmly in the camp of Team Caleb, and I think I'm still there. Although I have less conviction about it than I once did. I mean, you know, John's team, Cam, he's made that clear. And for a long time, we've been on opposite sides. But I will say that the way Cameron Boozer moved in those agility drills, and some of them, the lane, maybe it was the lane one where, his time, yep. You could compare it to,
yep.
to guards over the last, shooting guards over the last 25 years. The fact that he is 40 pounds heavier than Wilson and still moves like that, I thought, wow, because for those of us making the case that Wilson's going to play so much bigger in the league because of his superior athleticism, while clearly he's more explosive, what's clear is that Cam can move that big body. And so for me, sure, offensively, already being on the Wilson side of things, you look at Cam and you say, well, it's perfect fit next to Edie. He'll play the four. He can score from all levels. A lot of inside, outside. You figure with his ability to hit the three. What I was concerned about is defensively, moving those feet against those athletic fours that he's going to be facing on most nights, moving laterally. And what that, what his testing obviously showed is how well he can move that big body. So immediately he comes in with that strength and that mass, and he's able to, affect winning possibly earlier than Wilson. And so I would go back to what I said. Well, I still think Wilson has the higher ceiling. Cam Boozer, with what he proved in that agility testing, I just think, wow, he's going to come in immediately, help you win. And for all those other reasons, there are intangibles to this, where the franchise is in terms of needing to establish a culture. He's perfect for that. He's going to come in and be the ultimate franchise guy in terms of saying all the right things, and you won't have to worry about decision making. He's been raised to be a pro, being the son of a former All-Star. And so there's a lot of reasons to like Cam Boozer. There were already that going in. Hollinger's got him number one on his list of prospects, but I think there's even more, at least in my book, after what he did in the in Chicago this week.
Yeah, Jason, I couldn't agree more. Part of it is the safety that you feel with Cam Boozer and the high floor. And coming off of such a tumultuous period for the franchise, it feels like there's nothing wrong with casting your lot with the safe guy. Mm-hmm. Because look, you've seen what the production was at Duke, and it's like, all right, well, even if he doesn't have the same ceiling, my gosh, like, we know we can build a foundation on this guy in a way that feels a little bit less certain with Caleb Wilson.
Well, that, I don't think there's any question about it. Now, again, that's not to say Caleb Wilson can't be that guy and do everything right and be the professional and be a guy that you could put a microphone in the hands of like you used to do with Jaren Jackson Jr. and trust that he's going to say all the right things to fans. Like, I truly believe that Caleb is going to be a pro like that as well. That said, I think safety almost dismisses – you're right, because it is. It's the safer pick. And frankly, it might – it does feel like since the combine, there's been a little bit of a push from Gavoni and other guys. You just wonder what GMs are thinking to get Boozer even, to push him up. I don't think it's going to end up happening where he goes one, but you're talking about a guy who might go one. And again, who Hollinger, who worked in the front office, thinks is the best overall prospect in the draft. And so when we say safe, I mean, it almost sounds, dismissive of what I think is still an all-star ceiling, a guy who, maybe he makes it a couple of times, maybe not, but he's going to check a lot of boxes and maybe a star for you in some of those roles. Can he be your number one? No, I don't think so. In terms of building it all around him. And I'll be honest with you, and he touched on this, he's going to be more effective next to a big shot blocker like a Zach Edey. Well, for this front line to be formidable over the next however many years it's going to take, I mean, for you to stack up against the OKCs and everything else, Zach Edey's going to have to be there. And that's where I do wonder, again, Caleb to me is almost not that he can play center in this league, but I do believe he's a front court player that you can build around. If Cam's left by himself is my point, because Edey can't play because the health is a big factor. You saw in Bassini's breakdown that the same thing we've all been saying. If Edey stays healthy, this works out great. Whereas if Caleb is the next KG, that's a front court guy that you can build around. And the one thing that I think has been unfair a little bit to Caleb, because he didn't shoot it as much, and we talked to Aki Collins, the Maryland system, about this today. I mean, you look at what North Carolina did, he wasn't asked to do that, and the shot's not broken. So this idea that Caleb Wilson can never become this inside-outside guy, that right now Jalen Duren is not, right? This idea that he's just going to be Jalen Duren, I think you throw that out a little bit. The idea that he can't develop his shot, I think that's being unfair to the kid because he's got a good stroke on the shot. And if he comes anywhere near that, you know, KG, who ended up shooting 28% from three, I know the game's changed, but I didn't see a broken shot. I see a guy who, you know, may eventually develop that and be unstoppable and perhaps, you know, elite on both ends in a way that maybe Cam cannot be. I know that I've completely left your question now, but I think the discussion is, you know, it's a fascinating one. I still think that's going to be the choice, although, you know, if GMs are, you know, if they were as impressed by what Cam Boozer did as I was this week, who knows? Maybe we're talking Cam Boozer earlier and you've got a choice of, you know, Darren Peterson or Caleb Wilson. Who knows?
Yeah, it does kind of stink that it feels like if you like both guys, but you just lean towards one of them, it's like it's somehow become, you know, a legitimate like debate of picking a side. I kind of net out, and maybe this is unfair. It just feels to me like if you take Caleb and get it wrong, the penalty will be greater than being wrong about Boozer.
Yeah, and back to the point on the highest floor, I mean, being wrong on Boozer is what? He's still going to be a solid foundational piece for you.
He's still 6'9", 255.
Right, he's going to be, I would imagine, second or third in terms of your pecking order going forward in terms of being part of a core, especially with the way he can score from a bunch of different levels. And so losing on Boozer in that way, you're right. That goes back to safer. Again, not to say safer that this guy can't have a high ceiling and be, you know, that a great number two for you. That's a great point on Boozer, and probably even more reason why I'm a little less convicted on it. It's you know, in the end, it's a conversation that we didn't discuss nearly as much beforehand in the, you know, the lottery odds, the flattened lottery odds era. 06 had jumped to this spot, a top four spot. We were discussing, man, what if you end up with, you know, having to talk yourself into Michael Brown at eight or whatever it was. And so it is, Jeffrey Wild's layered, and it feels like everybody's taking sides, and it's a great choice to have. But that, I mean, in the end, it's a great choice to have because it beats the alternative of those spots that, you know, you had the highest likelihood of finishing of seven or eight. So either way, you're going to come away with a player that this franchise desperately needs, and it desperately needed this injection, quite frankly, of excitement and everything else with this, you know, being able to land one of the more elite talents. Not that those guards that we were trying to, you know, figure out which might look best with the Grizzlies won't be an elite talent, but I think having a choice of one of these guys really could expedite and fast forward this turnaround, you know, this rebuild, I should say, hopeful turnaround.
Well, the options at three are actually pretty straightforward. It's going to be Cam Boozer or Caleb Wilson. Maybe there's a world in which Darren Peterson is there at three, less likely, but
right.
There's hardly a universe in which one of those three guys isn't the pick. Where it gets interesting for these Grizzlies is having number 16 in a deep draft. Like, this is a spot where you could get a quality contributor, but not a sure thing. And so it then becomes a question of, like, what do you do with 16? Are we all in on it doesn't matter? We're taking the best guard available because we need a guard. Or, I mean, you look around and it's like there could be a quality four or a five man available there, which might seem redundant on top of a Cam Boozer or a Caleb Wilson. But to me, the 16 pick is the one where the options are probably going to be endless. You could go any number of directions. You could trade it. Like, what's your hope for how the Grizzlies cash that one in?
You know, there's a couple ways I suppose you could go. I guess my hope, Cobb, to answer your question, would be that Kleiman uses these assets he's got, including maybe 32 that I believe you've got from Indiana, to move up and get back up into that. I don't know what, you know, whether it's they did this last year with Coward. You know, maybe you can get to 11 or 12. We're not talking – Jeffrey touched on this. It's not going to be the same price it would be to certainly jump into the top four or the top six if you were one of those teams that's lower. You're talking about jumping from 16 to a high teen to a 12. If that's to get somebody like a LeBaron Filon, who you could tell yourself, oh, man, can we develop him into sort of our, you know, the lead guard that we are probably going to need, eventually after we've we've decided seemingly to move on from John Morant? Do you want to do that? It would depend on who's there, Kyle, but I would be ultra aggressive. I would take the biggest swing possible on trying to move back up. We know Kleiman does. He has a record for it. He's the penchant for it of moving up. And I would just listen. There is a good chance. This kid from Baylor. What is it, Carr Cobb? That's rising. Racine had him at 15. He pulled out of the workouts today because he's already exploded his stock. And so whether it's him at a 16, I think Bassini had him at 15. You can get a good player. Koa Pete, if he's still there, sure, you can get somebody good there, and maybe you'll have to, because like you said, this is a deeper draft, and overall the price will be higher to move up than probably it was last year, certainly, than it was to move up and get Cedric Howard. That said, my point, my hope would be that Zach is super aggressive, because not just in the the home run approach, hopefully, to whatever you do with three, but I would think, be aggressive, especially with your assets. This is the time to, if you're going to fast forward this thing, you're putting too much sort of weight on that number three pick if you're not being aggressive with all these other assets that you've acquired from trading Jaren Jackson, from trading Desmond Bane. And so I would say be aggressive and try to move up and get best player available. And if it fits, lead guard, because that's kind of the piece of the puzzle that right now it looks like you need to address, even though you got Ty Jerome that could do it right now or whatever, sure, but just go best available player there if possible. And frankly, it's something that I'm not just hoping for Zach Kleiman to do. I'm hoping is the plan, that aggressiveness. You want to, he said it. It really can't be a 5-year rebuild here. You've got a bunch of holes still, and so why not be as aggressive as possible, especially when you've got now an OKC type level of assets in terms of number. So I would say use those picks, even if it's something from 27, as opposed to, not just working with 16 and 32. If it's working with future picks to move up, I'd do that. I'd be as aggressive as possible.
I was kind of thinking about it like this. Is there a price that either of you guys would be like let's say it took three firsts for them to move up from 16 to 5, but they come out and they take Cam at 3 and they take Acuff at 5. Is there a price that y'all would feel like, I don't know, man, because I think I would kind of be at the point where it's like, I'd sit there and go, yeah, that was steep, but it kind of seems to me now like the lessons that we're learning is that for you to kind of change your circumstances, you got to be pretty aggressive. And yeah, maybe it brings out bottoming out, but like, man, if you told me on the Wednesday after the draft, if they left with Cam and Acuff, man, on Wednesday, I am so fired up to think about next season.
Oh, it's not just you. I think it's all the city. And I think like we talked about, you got those phones ringing down there in terms of season tickets. That's the kind of boost they need. Now in terms of would you spend it, what did you get it for? And I would say, looking back on the Bane haul, you were the envy of a lot of front offices for the four picks and the pick swap that you were able to get for Desmond Bane. And and this is not to put it on Desmond Bane, but he certainly wasn't the all-in piece that fitting the price that Orlando paid for that. And so my point being, you got all of these assets, so why not use them? We know next year's draft is certainly not going to match this one, and you've got these 27 picks. I mean, what is it, 12 over the next 6-7 years?
I think it's 11 now.
11 now, maybe, because they've gotten off some of them. But point being, if you're going to expedite this thing, don't save them, Zach Kleiman, for the next GM. If this thing's going slowly in 3 years, Isolo hasn't shown that he can do the job, and this thing, there's still a ton of first-round picks in the war chest. If you could pull off something like that, Jeffrey, yeah, I absolutely wouldn't be against it. This is the draft to do it in, all right? And you, again, in terms of assets in this league, you're right up there with the best of them. And so shoot your shot. Be as aggressive as possible. That's a different kind of excitement coming out of this draft. To be able to get two top five, top six, just guys we've talked all of what, all season about. I mean, that's, if I'm Zach Kleiman, and I'll be honest with you, I mean, he's getting a second crack at this in terms of this rebuild, right? You had a core that didn't work, got you a couple of two seeds, one playoff series win, and this is your crack at redoing it again and rebuilding it. If I'm Zach Kleiman, I'm going to be as aggressive as possible because this is my career. I mean, obviously it's my job. It's my job to get this organization back turned in the right direction and get him back to the top of the West. But this is also his career, and yeah, I would want to these picks that I've acquired. I'd want to spend them. So if that option is there, and I imagine, like you said, that price is going to be super steep. Then yeah, absolutely, you pull the trigger. Be as aggressive as possible. Otherwise, what'd you push the button for?
If Darren Peterson somehow, some way is there at three, Jason, is there any scenario in which you don't take him?
No, I asked John that question. If it ended up being DP and Wilson that you're making the choice between, we just talked it through because there was that buzz about Cam. I'm with you that I think the likelihood is Cam's still going to be there to pick at three and make the choice between him and Wilson. But if it did, I still think, you know, you those conversations, I asked John Fant today what you'd have to know. And it's basically that, you know, it's not going to be your, you know, he answered what we all would, I think, would say, that your entourage and your group are not the ones that are going to be making decisions going forward. And he pointed back to LeVar, you know, back to LeVar, who was running things all the way up until his kids got drafted. And once they did, you didn't hear from him anymore. And so there has to be that understanding and that, listen, everything about you medically is us now. Like that, you know, that we're a partnership now. We walk hand in hand. There is no, you know, withholding or whatever else. We run that now. And so, yeah, you would have to have that understanding and feel real good about it and that he's through these cramping issues and everything else. But, yes, Cobb, to answer your question, in the end, if that dude is Ant Edwards, goes back to something Jeffrey said. Like, you're the GM that passed on him, if that's what he ends up being. And, I would think he's got a little bit of a chip, too. And would have even more of one if he's fallen to three than, you know, if he is taken like we all think at two. And so he's got a chip already because folks have questioned the way he went about things this senior year, this 1 year he had at Kansas. So my thing is, my guess is he would come into the league feeling like he's got a ton to prove. And so, yes, I would take Darren Peterson, hoping for that high upside and really looking forward to what, you know, he could do at the two or three position from next to Cedric Howard, basically, on the wing here. Absolutely, I would take him over Wilson.
What do y'all think Kleiman would do? I'm not 100% convinced that he doesn't have Boozer one.
Interesting. You're asking what Kleiman would do.
Because I
between DP and...
I think I agree with y'all. I'm more curious, though, if Kleiman thinks like we do.
Well, I mean, he's the one with the history with the guy that, you know, was kind of in and out in the, you know, with Ja. And so I just wonder how much of the
I think that's got a weigh on him. I also I think you could talk me into like where they are maybe considering like durability. And I would have to think Cam Boozer projects to be pretty durable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just look at him. Look at the way he moves, and if he's been durable at every level. I mean, you know, Zach Edey was durable in college. You know, it is a different case study because of what Zach Edey is physically. And again, he's playing almost a different game in terms of how fast it is from college basketball, or at least what they were playing. But I think his man is Cam Boozer, and if he's got the chance to get him, no matter where he is, he's gonna grab him. Just Duke loving Duke.
Well, there's not a brother on the team anymore.
Isaiah Evans might be there at 32, so there could be another option to check that box. Just going to throw that out there.
That's possible. If you're using 32. But again, I mean, I guess, you know, we thought one thing about this roster, you know, before, I hate to even bring it up in this fashion, but you're going to have another open roster spot.
Yeah.
I would have said that. Because of Brandon Clark, I would have said going into this, right, the three rookies like on this team where you're going to have to consolidate some of this, what you've got already on the roster. But, maybe that's actually going to be possibly more likely. Maybe it's more possible now with, you know, obviously the tragedy is Brandon's passing.
It's made worse in the fashion. I think they probably are going to have that spot open anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's on an expiring. Either you know, whatever they're going to do with it, we don't know what was going to happen with the stuff off the court.
Yeah.
Either way, one way or the other, yeah, his future was certainly cloudy at best. That said, No, this is an opportunity clearly for Zach Kleiman to really be aggressive in maybe a generational draft. We'll see. We're looking forward to it. I'm just, you know, this time last week, we're all just kind of hoping and praying it could be anything in the top four. And so Memphis, the sports scene, the Grizzlies in particular, have got a nice little boost here. I think we all have. And yeah, it'll be fun in these weeks leading up to it, I guess, to try to figure out who's going to be.
I think the more that I ponder it, Cobb, I think the take I'm most convicted in, I don't think they're picking at 16.
Yeah, he's going to move up from there. Yeah, right.
I would think so.
And even if they can't move up, you could talk me into, because I think they're going to try to move up. But if they're at 16, you could talk me into they figure out a way out, or like, because it just feels like whatever's going to be available to them at 16 is not going to be what they're using the draft for. And I do think that they value the draft in terms of putting the roster together.
Well, not to mention the future of this front office depends. Jason,
it's
I don't know if you
point,
agree
Jason.
With me on this.
No, but Jason, but the same thing. Like, hey, you got
depends.
The chance to redo it.
And this is
right.
what they're known
this
for,
is
drafting. Exactly. You've got a golden opportunity here.
1,000%. That's what I was alluding to earlier. I mean, this is your job is to fix the Grizzlies, but it's also, it could be your future in the NBA. And so why would you, you know, sit on these picks, not be aggressive, plan, you know, at least take the, you say it's going to be, you know, your aim is to have a fast rebuild, but then take the approach and sitting on these picks that, you know, that it looks like, okay, well, you're just bringing in players here, you know, just very slowly. No, I mean, I think that's the point is you traded Desmond Bane, you traded Jaren Jackson. You've sort of owe it to the city to get this thing turned around quickly. So you go out and use them. You don't save them for the next general manager. And a league, a lot of it, you know, Zach's tenure with Memphis is going to be tied to Isolo, obviously in a lot of ways because of the way that happened. You know, firing Taylor Jenkins with 9 games left. Taylor's back in the – going to be a head coach again here. And so, you know, his success –
That's $10 million a year man, Taylor Jenkins, to you, right. Jason.
Tuomas Isolo has proven nothing, and yet Zach Kleiman, and not even, you know, opening it up for a coaching search afterwards, has tied himself to Isolo. And so in a lot of ways, you know, Zach Kleiman here going to be judged. So yes, I would to help my head coach, who I believe so much in clearly, and to get this franchise turned around as quickly as possible, I would be as aggressive as possible, even to the point, like Jeffrey said, where maybe it's not a 16 to 12 jump I'm looking for, but a 16 trying to get anywhere back in the top 10 I can. If I could pull off something like getting an A cup, I'm willing to be that aggressive and at least make those calls because, yes, my job and my career maybe in the NBA is on the line. Zach's still a young GM, and he's not going to get a bunch of chances at this. You wouldn't think. We don't know. We don't hear from Pera, but – and clearly there's a trust there, but yeah, he is on the line right now. All eyes are on Zach Kleiman. He certainly has the resources to, it would seem, to get this done.
Well, I also think there's this reality. No one knows what the future holds, but I paid attention when we started the draft lottery, and to a certain degree, hey, it's ESPN selling a television show that they're going to have, and it's the NBA draft, but Bobby Marks, you know, you've had him on your show many, many times. I wouldn't exactly consider Bobby someone that just says things for attention. He compared this draft to the best draft since 1996.
Yeah.
And yeah. How many – so if we're talking about a once-in-a-30-year draft, well, man, if you're not going to spend – if you're not going to spend picks now, like, if not now, when? Like, this right. is as good of a chance to – like, if someone goes, ah, man, that's a steep price, it's like, fine. If you get the right guys, like, who cares?
Well, and you are one of the teams with the money to do it, with the assets to do it. So why sit on them to that point? Not just this, plus, it's his history.
Yeah.
He has always looked to move up, even in years where he didn't have as deep a war chest. And so I'm with you, Jeffrey. This is the draft to be as aggressive as possible. And frankly, I like your idea in terms of not, you know, Why settle for a Filon if I can pay what some would say, yes, it'll be a steep price. That's the thing is these other teams know that too, that it's generational. They're going to make you pay through your teeth. But, you know, you got a haul that probably isn't possible right now. Again, when you look at the season Desmond Bane had, I've made this point, there were probably